Good afternoon, everyone. This is Refugee Wellbeing Promoters, Overcoming Barriers to a Healthy Life in the U.S. And so I'm going to discuss what those barriers to wellness and well-being in the U.S. are for resettling refugees and how we use resettled refugee women as health promoters or promotoras, health promoters to help overcome those barriers for families who are resettling. And I apologize, I was really hoping to bring some promoters with me and we couldn't get funding, but the ones who were going to come, one is actually literally in labor right now, so she wouldn't have been able to come anyways, and one is relocated to Utah because her husband found employment, and the other one is returning to Tanzania. So some of the challenges of the program, which I'll get into more. I have nothing to disclose. And so I'm briefly just going to introduce the IRC, the International Rescue Committee, which is where I'm working. And just so we're all on the same page, talk about who refugees are and their experience, and then go into some depth about refugee barriers to well-being, and then the program itself, some challenges, evaluation results, and our funding. So the IRC was originally founded in 1933 on request by Albert Einstein to help Germans who are suffering under the reign of Hitler. We're currently at work today in 40 countries and 22 cities in the U.S. The IRC is responding to the worst humanitarian crises across the world, and in the U.S. we're helping them in resettlement programs. And so in 1980, the Refugee Act established our current resettlement program in the U.S., and we're on contract with the Office of Refugee Resettlement. It's a federal program. And they kind of mandate the services that they see as essential core services. And those include providing immediate aid, including food and shelter, assisting with job training and job placement, giving access to clothing, medical attention, education, English language classes, and community orientation. And that doesn't meet all the needs of refugee resettlement. And so within resettlement agencies, we see a need for more programs, we can create those programs, but we do need to find grant funding for them, such as the program I coordinate. So who are refugees? In 1951, the Refugee Convention established the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and they created the definition of who refugees are, and it's a legal definition. And it is someone who, owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or political opinion, if they are outside the country of his or her nationality, and is unable to or owing to such fear is unwilling to avail himself of the protection of that country. So meaning if they're facing persecution and they can't return home. So migration patterns are constantly changing all over the world and increasing, and they're becoming more complex as times change. And they involve not just refugees, but also millions of economic, natural disaster, and now famine migrants, such as what's happening in Somalia. But refugees and migrants, even if they often travel in similar ways, they're fundamentally different. And for that reason, they're treated very differently under international law. Migrants, especially economic migrants, choose to move in order to improve the future prospects for themselves and their family. And so, kind of in simplistic ways, you can think of it as it's like push-pull. Migrants, economic migrants, and people who are choosing to come are pulled to the U.S. for desire to improve their life. Refugees are pushed here because they don't really have a choice. Refugees have to move because in order to save their lives or preserve their freedom. They have no protection from their own state, and often it's their own government that's threatening to persecute them. So if other countries do not let them in and do not help them once they are in, they may be condemning them to death or an intolerable life without sustenance and without rights. So in 1951, the UNHCR, and with the help of the IRC and other NGOs, they've been offering protection and assistance to tens of millions of refugees around the world. And so they're looking to provide durable, what are called durable solutions. And so when refugees flee from their original home country into a refugee camp or a second country, they're waiting. And they're waiting for these durable solutions, which is ideally the first one is voluntary repatriation, meaning that they're going to be able to return to their home country. They're going to get to go back home and continue to live their life. The second one is second country integration, meaning that the country that they have fled to will allow them to integrate into that country legally. Often that's not an option. The last option is resettlement into a third country, meaning they're going to come to a country like the U.S. or Canada or Australia, some European countries. But on average, the wait in these second countries or these refugee camps is 10 years. Tucson is a very large Bhutanese community, and the refugees who are coming from Bhutan and the camps in Nepal, on average, are living there on about 18 to 22 years. So they're really just waiting. And of all refugees, really only 1% will make it to a third country. And of that 1%, 50% are settled in the U.S. So despite having already overcome, trauma and conflict and persecution, even once the refugees come in the U.S., they're facing a plethora of barriers, preventing them from achieving a life of well-being once they're here. And so kind of overarching everything is their prior experiences in, their conditions in, and the status in their home country and the refugee camp. So that's over everything. And then everything in these other kind of circles, they all link together. You can draw arrows from all of them. And so I'm going to start with kind of the low socioeconomic status. When refugees arrive in the U.S., they arrive with whatever they have, whatever they could carry. And so when they arrive, they're already placed in the lowest socioeconomic status, generally speaking. And so if you couple that with the current poor economy, they're limited or no English skills often. Sometimes they come highly educated, but their degrees aren't transferable, or they have very little formal education, or they have job skills that aren't transferable, or they're coming without job skills. There's also a lack of job opportunities, so as if you missed the introduction, we're based in Tucson. Lack of job mobility, low-paying jobs, lack of inadequate public transportation. So there's often a difficulty in accessing ESL classes. And very often large families where only one person is employable, so they're having one income for each of those families. And often this can lead to kind of lack of safe and affordable housing. And then, so I just mentioned low education, non-transferable job skills. Often they're also, what's contributing to this is many are arriving without even being literate in their own language. When the U.S. accepts refugees to come, we accept them based on humanitarian aid, not on their ability to become self-sufficient. And often the children aren't prepared for school because of lack of education opportunities in the camps or in the second countries or in their home country. And also, or if they did have education, they also aren't coming with their transcripts. And so they're not placed necessarily at grade level, or they don't have the English skills to be placed at grade level. And then they're facing acculturation difficulties. Little knowledge of U.S. culture coming in the camps. They'll receive a crash course in cultural orientation, and it can be anywhere from about 1 hour to 40 hours. And it varies from country to country. They often come with very high expectations of the U.S., of what life is going to be like, of the successes they're going to have, and how easy life is going to be, and it's not often the reality. They're facing a duality of cultures, fear of Americanization and loss of culture, language barriers, of course. And then the traditional kind of familial roles and responsibilities are challenged. Changes in the family hierarchy get flipped upside down when children tend to acculturate faster and they learn the language. They're often kind of placed at a more powerful level in the family. Traditional support systems are unavailable, and this can lead to stress and sometimes domestic violence in the home. Oh, I'm still going.
I just want to say.
Yeah, all right. And then systems navigation. We're such a systems-oriented culture. We have systems and services for everything. And they come here and they don't know about them. They don't know how to navigate them. It's the financial system, education system, health system, transportation system, DES, immigration, insurance, other social services. And within those, they face language barriers. They don't necessarily, there's an ambiguity regarding when they need to reapply and termination of benefits. And they're often isolated from these services. And then they face sometimes marginalization and discrimination. I'm sure many of you have heard about kind of the tensions in Arizona around SB 1070 or immigration laws. And a lot of this marginalization stems from the general public not necessarily understanding who refugees are and that they're here legally and they've been invited here and we're helping them. There's often a fear of law enforcement or negative interactions with law enforcement. And on the refugee side, a lack of understanding of U.S. laws and rights. And knowing that they can self-advocate and even that, and often then, but they still don't have the ability to self-advocate or know how to self-advocate. So all these factors confound, and we go to health, and so of course poor access to health. Often they come with unrealistic expectations of health services. They come thinking our medical system is great, we have the best doctors. If I come with any ailment, it's going to get fixed. And that's often not the case. There's sometimes cultural insensitivity from health providers, lack of transportation getting to the medical appointments, lack of trained medical interpreters, cultural and religious beliefs restricting U.S. health practices, cultural stigma around health and mental health, low or no health literacy, U.S. health literacy. Often they don't know about or can't access preventative health services due to Medicaid limitations. In our Medicaid program, we refer to it as access. There's a general lack of health knowledge often. Many times they're coming with pre-existing health conditions, which include mental health, PTSD. Many of our clients are survivors of torture. Chronic pain resulting from their flight or their fleeing. Or the torture, chronic disease, undernutrition. There's poor maternal and child health, and refugees also report being less assertive during doctor's visits. And then there's always this kind of misunderstanding around our pharmacy system about how you get medication, who provides it to you, and then you receive your medication, and it's all in English. So the well-being promotion program. On top of these barriers that I mentioned, it became evident through the resettlement practices in Tucson that women were often being left in the shadows. The gender inequities in their own culture have often left them less educated and less confident than their male counterparts, making them less equipped than refugee men when adjusting to American society. So this program began in 2008 to respond to these barriers and limitations. And we do this through home visits, and these home visits are providing education, and I'll talk more about what the topics cover. They provide referral to the systems and services and social services within Tucson. And then the promoters are acting as advocates, but also teaching self-advocacy skills to their clients. It's not specifically a health intervention program. We're not targeting cancer. We're not doing smoking cessation. It really is building awareness and knowledge and skills within the community to help them resettle and enter into the health continuum and get and be able to resettle in Tucson. Additionally, if we're going to be putting more refugees into these social services, we need to capacity build the service providers. If they're going to be serving more refugees but don't have the skills or the ability or the knowledge to do it, they're not providing a service to anyone. So myself and some other people at the IRC will go to the service providers and do what we call refugee 101s and educate the providers about who the refugees are, the refugee community in Tucson, how to work with them, intercultural communication skills. We're always open to them to come and talk about clients or cases or troubles they're having. And then we provide two fairs a year. One is a general community services fair, where everything from Boys and Girls Clubs and Girl Scouts and other social services, just other community services, come together. And last year we had about 500 refugees attend, and we're able to link with these community resources. And then we also do a health fair, which just happened 2 days ago. And that's more health-centered, and there's screenings and reapplication for Medicaid. And we had about 40 tablers this year from the Tucson community, and I don't know what our count was this year, but last year we had 1,000 refugees attend, and the year before it was 500, so we continue to grow. So the promoters are the heart and soul of this program. They're amazing women, and as a result, I love my job and going to work and working with them every day. We have them hired on as independent contractors, and so they're paid per home visit for every home visit they perform. They get $25 per home visit. They're all refugee. Most all of them are refugee women themselves. I currently have 7 promoters, 3 Nepali speakers from Bhutan, 2 Arabic speakers, 1 from Iraq and 1 from Jordan, and they also cover the Sudanese Arabic speakers. 1 Somali speaker from Somalia, and then 1 Swahili speaker from Tanzania, but covers the other Swahili-speaking countries, people who speak Swahili from being in Kenya refugee camps. I'll be hiring 3 more promoters in November to cover new ethnic groups that we're receiving. And that's going to include a Tigrinya speaker from Eritrea, a Cuban Spanish speaker, and either another Nepali or Somali. Currently, with our ethnic makeup, we can cover 84% of refugee women and arrivals in Tucson. And so the women are all bilingual and literate in their native language and English, but that varies in terms of skill. They have experience in community organizing and or in public health within their home country or the refugee camps. They have strong intercultural communication skills, and they've all been resettled in Tucson for at least about 2 years, and so they have a knowledge of the local Tucson area health and human service network and kind of the system within Tucson. So when the promoters are hired, they go through 40 hours of what we call orientation and kind of pre-service training or pre-job training. And the orientation covers home visitation, education models and curriculums, community resources, the referral processes, home visitation practices, best practices for home visits such as case noting, creating an action plan for their clients, writing learning objectives for each topic they go over, evaluation, and resiliency and boundary setting. Often the clients have unrealistic expectations of what the promoter will do for them, and they're such a support to them because they speak their same language that they'll often try to just put everything onto the promoter. So we really talk about trying to, how do you set boundaries and create that with your client. They also will shadow veteran promoters, and then additionally, every month they participate in 3 hours of continuing education and professional development, and then 1 hour a month at the start of each month they come to review their case notes with me. We talk about how the client's doing, what the next topics are going to be, make any referrals necessary, and then myself or my program intern will perform ongoing home visitation monitoring. A little bit on the curriculum. I found that kind of existing evidence-based curriculum that's out there for promotora programs or community health worker programs or health education in general, they often target vulnerable populations, but they're generally targeted for Spanish and African American populations only, and they're really based on Western approaches that don't take into account the distinct cultural differences and experiences of refugee ethnic groups. And so because of this, we create most of our curriculum in-house at the IRC and or adapt it from existing curriculums. So the roles of the promoters, and since they couldn't be here, they helped with this presentation, and these are their words about the roles they play. So they are social supports. They haven't been formally trained in counseling, but they often act as informal counselors by going into the home and forming these relationships because they're refugees themselves. They have been through this resettlement process that's extremely challenging, and so they really are this kind of support network for the refugees. They act as a bridge between the people's culture and the U.S. culture, so they're able to answer the questions about, you know, why do everywhere I go do I have to fill out paperwork? Why doesn't it all just go to one place? I keep filling out the same paperwork. A lot of mistrust around paperwork and misunderstanding. They're educators. They're educating about everything. and I'll talk more about that. I mentioned the advocacy. They're advocates for themselves. They're advocates for their clients, the refugee community. But we've really started working on building self-advocacy skills within the home and with the clients and their kids and the fathers. And then assurance. They're really assuring that they're making sure refugees get into community resources that are available. And Tucson has some really great programs that refugees are isolated from, and the promoters will make the referrals and explain what these programs are and help get them into them. So the promoters, their responsibilities, they mentioned they're going to complete the 40 hours of training. They make around 20 home visits to each client, and I'll go into more detail on that in a second. They have to complete case notes or service notes for each visit, make necessary referrals, and then they administer the post and pre-evaluation surveys that we use. And then they also have a voice and a huge role in assisting with the curriculum development because it's not all that effective of me trying to develop curriculum for these ethnicities that I've never lived with. And so they really provide the expertise on if this curriculum is going to fly or not fly. They have no problem saying, this isn't going to work. They also make sure all their paperwork is completed accurately and on time. They participate in the monthly case note reviews and then any other duties that I ask them to do.
So they get
paid for all that as well. So their home visitation schedule, the current one that's up on the screen, is relatively new. The feedback we had received from clients and promoters was that our old system wasn't enough. We were trying to do too much and too little of time. And so the current system was, for the first 6 to 8 months, the woman and her family had arrived in Tucson. She only got about 6 to 8 visits. And there's a lot to learn. And it was too much information in one visit, and the visits were lasting for 3-4+ hours, and wasn't the most effective. And so after talking with the promoters, we decided on this schedule, which we've been doing since about May. And so the program's now a year long. And their first 30 days of arrival, the client will receive 1 to 2 visits a week. And the first visit is focusing on kind of building rapport and getting to know the family and building a trust. The first couple visits are. Months 2 through 6, the clients will receive 2 visits per month, and months 7 through 12 will receive 1 visit per month. So the topics. The first 6 months really focus on kind of the survival skills and addressing kind of that deer in the headlights reaction to resettlement and this isn't what I was expecting. I have so much to learn. And then the second 6 months we'll focus on kind of once that has somewhat worn off, we'll focus more like once they might have the luxury to worry about their health and mental health, we'll focus more on physical and mental health topics. So the first 6 months, generally right away, we address public home and personal safety, talking about 911, the difference between emergency, urgent, and primary care. And it goes from everything from this is how you cross the street safely. You push this button, you wait for the walk person to tell you to walk, and then you walk across the street. It addresses for some families the basics of, you know, power outlets and the safety around power outlets, how to cook on your stove, making sure you don't cook food directly on the burner, how to use your refrigerator. If you have a microwave, you know, what you can put in the microwave and not put in it, and how long that actually takes. If apartments have pools, pool safety. And then often go into personal and home hygiene about how now, remember, if a lot of people have been spending their whole lives in these camps, they weren't necessarily living with electricity, running water, and plumbing. So how do you clean your home now that you're in these apartments with carpet and counters and toilets? Then quickly move on to DES benefits and food stamps. And introducing a concept of what invisible money is. So they get their food stamp or EBT card, which has this allotment of money on it, but you never actually see the money, and it buys things, but it doesn't buy everything. And so kind of talking about the limitations of that. Sorry? Yeah. And so talking about DES and food stamp benefits and how you make that invisible money last for an entire month. Then they explain, start to explain the different systems, work on navigation, public transportation, the bus system in Tucson, which I can't even understand. Somehow they get people who aren't even literate in their own language to understand it. Financial literacy, starting with the value of money and recognizing money, up to opening bank accounts and learning how to use the ATM card if you don't speak English, and what happens if your ATM card gets eaten into the machine, and how if you don't have any money in your bank account, the bank still lets you take money out, but you're going to get charged for it later. And then self-advocacy and referral skills are kind of ongoing. Some of the health issues, just quickly, they address nutrition and exercise, family planning, pregnancy, well woman visits, medication in the pharmacy, diabetes, and asthma, and then home hygiene and bed bugs and cockroaches. Oops, nope, go back one more. And some of the referrals we make are, we have a relationship with WIC. They come to our office every Tuesday morning to do WIC enrollments for refugee families, which has been a fantastic partnership. refer to nurse family partnership home visitation programs, Raising Healthy Kids, which is another home visitation program for kids 0 to 5, a public health nursing program, Family Passages, which is a parenting program for refugees, Early Head Start, Head Start, and other mental and behavioral health services. So, oh, sorry, still one more.
Really? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right.
I see, you're turning the page.
So, program challenges, because this program is so diverse and we're working with so many ethnic groups, it does make creating curriculum difficult because we can't target it to one specific population, and that is where the strength of the promoters comes in, and they're the ones who can really tailor the education to their own cultures. And so we'll work with them on how, kind of the skills of how then you then teach that information through training of trainers. Varying education levels of the promoters. I've got one promoter who's working on her master's degree and others who don't have high school degrees. And also then, of course, varying levels of education within the clients. Pregnancies and children. A lot of the promoters I've had so far, I think I've had 3 pregnancies, which is fantastic, but a lot of their social norms and beliefs around pregnancy limits what they can do, and like the promoter who's in labor right now she's Somali, and so she's not going to leave her house for 3 months because that's their practice. And similarly with clients, you know, so often that creates scheduling conflicts, not only between pregnancies and children, but the promoters are independent contractors, but they're not full-time, and so all of them also have second jobs, and as well as clients who are often working multiple jobs, so trying to create a schedule for the promoters and the clients and all of us to come together is a challenge. Transportation difficulties. I mentioned our public transportation system is atrocious, and some of the promoters have vehicles, some don't. And then referrals. Often we'll make referrals, but a lot of these services, they're not specifically targeted to refugees, so there's often a long waiting list because the whole community is trying to get into these services. And many of the agencies we're also referring to will say they want to serve refugees. Of course we want to serve refugees. I'll ask if they have language services. They say, yes, of course, we're bilingual. You know, we speak Spanish and English, which isn't helpful for a majority of our refugees. And then the unrealistic expectations of the promoters, that the promoters, they're so accessible and they're so empathetic, and they, even though we work on boundary setting, often they will never say no. They go above and beyond. And so really trying to emphasize that, you know, the promoters are here to educate and provide knowledge. They're not here to do it for you. So, sorry? Oh, that's great. So we use a post and pre-evaluation survey, which was designed by an external evaluation. Jean McClellan is actually in the back of the room. She designed a great post and evaluation survey. And we do post and pre. And we do the post and pre because, as I mentioned earlier, that distrust of paperwork. If we were going into the home right away and doing these pre-tests, it wasn't welcoming. And so this allows us to test knowledge at the end of the program and have them reflect on what they knew before and what they know now. And also helps because we have limited capacity and resources. And so we use a 1 to 10 scale, 1 being knowing nothing or understanding nothing, and 10 after the program knowing everything. And so we're looking at ranking their level of knowledge and understanding on where to get resources and support, what to do if there's an emergency, the health, education, financial system, understanding those in Tucson, and the resettlement process, and then ranking confidence on their ability to adjust to life in Tucson and their ability to help others access resources. And so we have a 91.57 to 93% increase in confidence understanding, and from a 1 to 7.7, and that was, we started doing the survey in October, and so at the time we collected, and now this is N equals 83, so 83 participants. Overall home visit satisfaction is 8.4, and overall usefulness, 8.8 of the materials. And so then the qualitative side of it, we asked about if any information was not useful. Generally, people didn't have much to say on that. We had 3 people who mentioned age and disability barriers to using the information, and then language challenges. We didn't actually ask about positive aspects of the home visits, but generally people listed them, just the general information. Information they still desired and suggestions for improving home visits overwhelmingly always mentioned job and vocational skills, which is kind of outside of our program, but I can take that back to the IRC and take it to our employment program and carry those results forward. And so summarize up with some client quotes. So this is from an Iraqi woman. She's a single mother. She has two kids. I was so happy to find someone who spoke my same language, shared my same culture, and guided me from my arrival. I now feel confident. And this is from a Bhutanese woman. She's married with three children. I learned so many good informations and knowledge from the home visits because you covered most all the basic information that we need to survive in life here. I now know the uses of bus pass, food stamps, access, that's our Medicaid program. I know the value of money, safety in the apartment, to reapply to the DES after 6 months, and the importances of ESL school. I also learned to make doctor appointment and reschedule the appointment, and I know to take my baby to the doctor for well check. I can get the things I need from the resources. I swear I couldn't have made up a better quote. And our funding is through, our main source of funding is through the Office of Refugee Resettlement, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. We have a state Arizona Refugee Resettlement Program, and then the Southern Arizona Women's Foundation. That's it. Thank you.
I have a couple minutes for questions more, and then we'll open it back up for both of our presenters.
I also have a cohort of about 11 youth college advocates from very diverse populations. What tactics have you used to help that cohort with cohesion? We're very new. We're just going through orientation now,
mm-hmm.
but I probably have about 7 different cultures in my cohort.
Mm-hmm. So we've been working on, so we meet once a month for these continuing orientation sessions where I'll work on some team building, sharing of the home visits, sharing what similar struggles between our clients, a lot of dialoguing, bringing food in, kind of cross-cultural stuff, getting to know you stuff. It has been a kind of a work in progress. They were pretty isolated, but now are learning to recognize themselves as a support system within themselves and talking. Some of them are kind of more veteran promoters and helping the others, you know, learn how to talk to clients about, oh, like, this is something I can't do for you. And so, yeah, mostly during those three-hour sessions. They're not, I would love to have them get to the point where they're socializing and stuff outside of those sessions, and that's not happening. The three Nepali promoters will be together, but within mixing in terms of outside of the program, they're not. Oh, sorry. Oh, you're the moderator. You do it. I'm overstepping.
I just have a question in terms of what the promoters are addressing in terms of the time frame.
Mm-hmm. So that it's not set in stone. So when they get new clients and have done a few visits for them, they'll create an action plan of kind of what topics are going to be covered and when. That's the general trend. If there's something immediate that needs to be addressed earlier, those referrals get made right away, and those topics will be covered right away. So, yeah, it's totally flexible, but that's kind of the trend we see. We do find that if you start addressing preventative care and things like that too early on, or nutrition and exercise, it just doesn't – they're so worried about having to make their rent payment in 6 months and making their utilities and having their gas cut off, that it doesn't work early on. So, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So the IRC's resettlement system has case managers who are doing medical case managers, and we have a behavioral health and mental health program in-house, and so it's not solely relying on the promoters, and the promoters are not supposed to be acting as case managers. I have 3 current Nepali promoters. I'll probably be hiring on another one because that's our largest group.
Well, that was my question. The new promoter you've hired them yet. I was mm-hmm. wondering, did they come from the ranks of a client that had been served? I just wondered, were you seeing this promotion, leadership from the promoters to the clients to become promoters?
So I'll be hiring them next month. So I haven't actually put out the job description yet, but I would imagine most likely it will probably be a prior client, but not necessarily. But there are I have heard from my Nepali promoters because I've let them know that we're interested in picking up another one. Yeah, and they have said that women have come up to them asking, how do I do this? And the promoters themselves, because the program's new, and since 2008, and they've all been here prior to 2008, this didn't exist for their resettlement process, and all of them say that they're promoters because this was something they didn't have and would have liked to have had.
Like, to be able to see that progression.
Yeah. Like health insurance or liability? They are hired on as independent contractors through the IRC, and I think our insurance, our IRC insurance covers that, I believe. I'm not actually sure, though. The program manager would know that more than myself. I'm sorry, I can't answer that. I'm not sure.
So I don't know if anyone has questions in general for both of the Arizona programs. Join us back here. I just wanted to open it up for everybody because, in general, at our section, we'll have the questions at the end, but we had accommodated that the speaker had to leave. But, yeah, of course, continue. We have about 7 or 8 more minutes. Yeah.
I just had a comment. I think your program is remarkable. And I like how culturally and very ethnically sophisticated it is. Based on my own experiences, sometimes I've had spoke with some refugee community in Minnesota, and sometimes when you identify with a specific culture, you get so much more out of them because of the trust issue. It's fair when you're coming from the same world as well. I think your program is absolutely, I like the model, it's absolutely wonderful. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Such a coincidence that Lorraine and I were on this panel together because we've never actually met, but we've been playing phone tag for months now, trying to make that happen.
Hi, Lorenza, thank you for your presentation. It's good to see you again. Lauren, my question is actually for you. As a national organization, you work very hard to establish a CHW definition and identity, and a core element of that definition that's evolved over the years is shared life experience with the people that we serve, and clearly we're respecting that quality. But the other aspect of CHWs is building capacity and community, and so many CHWs, the people that CHWs serve wind up becoming CHWs, so I guess my question is related to the one that was asked previously, but are you finding that your CHWs are encountering people that they serve that now want to do the same kind of work, and can you support that development?
Yeah, so that's, what we have clients who have been approaching the promoters as wanting to do that, and now, so I'm currently at 7, I'll be hiring 3 more in November, but it is, it's going to be to reflect our newest ethnic groups that are coming in, so I'll be drawing from a pool that hasn't received the promotion services, except for the new either Nepali or Somali promoter I bring on, who will probably be a former client. To expand, we would need more funding, and so.
My question wasn't, does your program have that capacity, but are you able to help your CHWs be empowered to do that themselves in their community?
To do
that themselves in their own community. To help others
to help
do their work that they do.
Yeah, I know that within the Nepali community, cause that community is a really close-knit, community-oriented group, and so they will, I've heard that their clients are going in and talking to their neighbors and saying, hey, this is what I know, this is what I learned, you got this letter in the mail, I recognize that logo, that's your DES letter, you're going to have to reapply, take that into the resettlement agency and re-up, so...
That's cool if you can document that secondary.
That would be great.
I wondered if you encountered in the journal, two special issues. You know, the APHA is having a special issue come out this coming month in Community Health Workers, and then we have these two IRST issues in the Journal of Ambulatory Care. And I wanted to point out that we have a Community Health Worker Voices section in these two journal issues where Community Health Workers are writing about their own experience both domestically and internationally. And the person who coordinated this with me was a former Community Health Worker in an Ethiopian refugee camp. He's a Somali refugee himself, and so now he came to the U.S. And I'm wondering if you see any of that kind of skills transfer of refugees coming in who've worked as community health workers themselves. I don't know if that's come up, or it seems like a place to look for.
I think I've had teachers and principals and Gina. Can you think of anyone who's a CHW in the camps?
I think
so. A lot of educators and people who can't necessarily be teachers here, because they're, according to US, not qualified, but want to continue that practice, and so it comes naturally to them. But yeah, that would be something.
It's an interesting thing because the CHWs in the international context are often much more present, so that it'd be an interesting way to bring some transferable skills. But I know Sergio has a piece in here. A number of different people played a role reviewing and helping. So just wanted to mention these are out now as well. But both these programs are so valuable, and I love that cross connection you're making to make sure that the ASCHAP has the diversity of the CHWs in your state. Any other questions or comments you have? I think that's only six. Okay, so we have like one more minute, and any last burning questions? Well, I want to thank our presenters.